So again, we try to put all the people in those different categories. And then obviously, if I point, for instance, if I have an artist I like a lot that has a lot of potential, but that is in the artist category, I try to advise this artist to either find an agent or to find a collective of other artists or whatever, so that they can grow. Because you know, some of them are extremely talented, but indeed they might miss the little thing that requires to be successful. And at the end of the day, you know, it's not perfect math or perfect, you know, processes. There's a lot of magic, and sometimes, you know, there's something that happens, and something there is simply doesn't happen. So we have to also acknowledge that.
We are back. NFT Now podcast. Ale, how we doing?
I'm feeling a little tired, man. My son kept me up last night, but you know what we did? We did a little bit of authenticated content. You know, one of the things I'm really excited about the blockchain specifically is really the proof of provenance around authenticity of content. And, you know, I got to shill our own bags here, but we did launch Sovereignty earlier this year, which is our Web3 CMS that helps digital publishers authenticate media. I know that's a big blurb, but it keeps our consumers safe. It keeps our readers safe. It lets people know that the people writing it stand behind it and it's truly who they say they are. But outside of that, man, I'm really excited for today's conversation. I think we're taking a new turn, a new guest. I think we're bringing a whole new topic to the table. And without further ado, who do we have on, Matt?
We have Jean-Michel Pelhon, longtime Ledger executive turned co-founder of Grail Capital, on a mission to make digital art the next $1 trillion asset class. He has been super active as an investor and a curator and a collector in the digital art space. I'm super excited to get his take on the market, especially at this juncture. What are you excited about, Ale?
I'm excited just to have him on. You know, he's been such a key player in the NFT space, in the community, from Ledger days to now. He's a great community builder. And I'm actually kind of very, very excited. I think Jean-Michel may be one of the first ones for one of our first guests that comes from a financial lens of our industry. So I'm excited to hear his thoughts on the financialization of NFTs.
Likewise. Well, let's get into it. Before we do, if you don't already, give our newsletter a little follow, nftnow.com/newsletter. Every week, we're bringing all the action straight to your inbox. Without any further ado, Jean-Michel. Jean-Michel on the NFT Now podcast. I'm here for it. How you doing, man?
Very well, Matt. And super, super happy to be with you and with Alejandro. So let's kick it off.
Hey, man. Like, you know, I think this is a long time coming. You've been an incredible player in the crypto blockchain space for a long time, and you've definitely helped pioneer a lot of adoption while at your time at Ledger. But then, you know, a year or so ago, you decided to go on your own, you know, leaving what is supposed to be one of the most stable, most profitable crypto-based companies in this space that only has massive upside. Let's talk about that journey. How did you get into Ledger, and walk us through how you're here today with your fund, things of that nature, and focus on all things digital art?
Oh, yeah, my God. So my story, I don't know how much time to do that, so I will try to summarize it in 2 minutes. So basically, I know Ledger before it was created because I started to be a friend with the initial CEO, Eric Larchevêque, who is now on TV in France and relatively famous in France. And I knew him, and he told me that he created this company. And I remember saying to him, congrats, but like, in a way, the kind of congrats you say to someone politely, you know? So he said, hey, it is Ledger.
so French of you.
You know, it is Ledger, we are doing hardware wallet. And I said, well, congrats, but, you know, I don't know. It was in late 2014, you know, around October or November 14. And it's funny because when I said that, there's a kind of something in my mind that told me, okay, you will remember this moment. This is this kind of moment, like when you meet someone and there is something that is happening at the same moment. And fast forward a couple of years after, when the company started to be, you know, found kind of its market, product market fit, there were 15 at the time. Eric, hey, come along. He knew me from some years. He knew that I was relatively good at finance and strategy. And I basically jumped into the into the crypto space full time because and thanks to Ledger. And that has been an amazing journey for 6 years. And during that journey, basically, I discovered NFT very naturally. And I was a collector of street art. If I move a little bit, you might see a Banksy over there just behind me.
Yeah.
And I was, and over there, there's a Space Invader and stuff. So I am a relatively big collector of street art for quite some time. And basically, you know, street art and NFT, there was a lot of connection between the two. And I basically jumped into the NFT space. And fast forward, and I will finish on that. You know, obviously coming from finance, working in crypto for 6 years, being a collector of both NFT and many other kind of art, I said, okay, it's too good to be true. And this thing that I have in front of me will be huge. And I love Ledger. I was having dinner yesterday with Pascal, the CEO in Geneva. And I love the company. I love everything they do. But at some point I said to myself, okay, I want to do my stuff that will be basically a collector investment fund for digital art on blockchains. And it's like impossible not to do it, you know? So I had, and voilà. And so I discussed with Pascal, I discussed with the board, and then I decided to create Grail Capital, but I'm not alone in Grail Capital, by the way. I know that I'm a bit the front person, but there's also the man in behind that is Tim Salikov, that is actually based in New York, that you guys have met a couple of times, I think. That Tim is very, very, very smart. A bit shy, so he's not the kind of guy that shows up at most of the events, but very structured, very articulated in his way to analyze the market. So I'm more the instinct guy, the guy who has some vision regarding the market and regarding the artworks, and he's the guy that basically back it with some data and quantitative analysis. So boom, that's the story.
I love it. Tell us a bit about the decision to start a fund around digital art, because you know, one doesn't just lightly start a fund, right? You know, that's especially in the midst
of a bear market too.
In the midst of a bear market, yeah. like that's a big jump. That's a big jump, and that's a very different. That's like the nature of running a fund and also raising for a fund like that. That's quite different than what you're doing before. So, like, what was that like journey of learning like? Like, how did you learn what to do? How did you go from, you know, all that time at Ledger to like pioneering this like nascent digital art fund and also distinguishing it against those who are already in the market?
Well, that's. Again, that's something that was in me and I could not stop it to happen, basically. But I'm trying to rationalize things and I said to myself two simple things. First thing, I've been in crypto. I did three or four cycles already, up and down and bear and bull, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that the best moment to invest and to launch a business is during a bear market. Yes, it's tough. Yes, it's very difficult to raise money. It's very difficult to find your product market fit. But as soon as you have a little bit of traction, then when a bull market arrives, you are well positioned. And you are not running after the market. You are ahead of the curve and ahead of the wave. Just like when you are doing some surf, you know, you are waiting a bit offshore and then you see the good wave coming and then boom, it's very, very swift and cool. So basically, that's the first component. And the second component is that if you look at things bluntly, the digital art market on blockchain, so what we call between ourselves NFT art, is a 3 years market. From a market perspective, so, you know, with many segments, with a bit of data, etc., it's from March 21. You know, basically, it's really the Beeple moment that basically changed everything. And then we had the summer of JPEG, etc., etc. But I mean, that's really a 3 years market. So that's a very, very small. And a year ago, when I launched Grail Capital, it was a 2 year market. So, but obviously I've been around on a couple of things before, and I think that to be good and to be one of the best in your ecosystem, you don't need to be the first one, but you have to be among the first one. And if you look at even the history of whether it's crypto, whether it's business, whether it's, I don't know, art in general, usually most of the people who are successful are in the first peer group, in the first group of people of a certain cycle. So if you take the impressionist, the cubist, you know, the street artist, etc., all those movements, they are, you know, the guy who eventually made it, they were part of the first pack. They were not necessarily the very first one, but they were in the first pack. So I wanted to be on the first pack on the collector and on the investor side. So voilà, those are the two reasons why I launched in the bear market. And I knew it, by the way. I knew that I was in a bear market that will be at least a 1 year difficult time. But now we are about to exit the bear market also for NFT art. So, you know, eventually it will be easier, I guess, in a couple of months.
And so when you think about building in a bear, because you said you have multiple elements, like what sustained you through this process? Because digital art held its price, right? NFTs went to zero, but digital art kept sustaining, right? When we speak about it, what started the bull market was art, right? In 21 was always about art. It's always been about art, right? Like what, from your perspective, like what is it about digital art that people really love and help sustain the market? Because it...
That's a great question. Thank you, Ale, for asking. I think, again, I'm trying to focus mostly on the art part and not so much on the collectible, even though sometimes the line between the two are very blurry. Like, for instance, for me, CryptoPunks, they are both collectible and they are art. You know, they are culture, they are art, and they are collectible. Bored Ape, for me, it's culture and it's community and collectibles, obviously, but it's not art. With all due respect to the great artists who made them. So again, I'm more skewed toward the art thing because that's something I understand relatively well. And again, everything I'm doing, every artist I'm meeting, every artworks I'm collecting, whether professionally or personally, I always think to myself the question, which is, will this thing, this person or this artwork can enter a museum one day? Mm. And that's basically literally everything I do. That's also why sometimes it takes me some time, because sometimes I'm not sure. It's not that I don't like the artist or I don't like the artwork. It's just that I need some time to educate myself, to understand what lies behind the image and behind the story, basically, the narrative and the context as well, which is very important. So I try to be a little bit intellectual in the way I approach art, whether as collector or as investor. But I must say that there's a funny thing, that there is an instinctive kind of way to look at it. And because I've been collecting a little bit of stuff that I've been working relatively well in the past, something kind of, I'm almost trying to back my kind of feeling or instinct with what I can see from the market. And I also honestly ask a lot of people around me, whether other collectors or other artists. And that's a big learning. The best collectors are probably the artists themselves.
That's an interesting take, actually. Let me ask you this question. Being a collector that you have been, and you curated a lot of the collection for Ledger as well. Is there a checklist? You know, like doctors have a checklist, pilots have a checklist, right? Is there a formula that you look for? You're like, hey, art had to be minted before this date. This artist has to do this. It's generative. It has to be AI. Like, is there a checklist for the artists out there looking to be collected by Grail Capital?
yes, there is. No, it's a very good question, and yes, there is. Because and again, I've got two caps, my collector cap and my investor cap, and those are slightly different. Obviously, each of them kind of nurture the other, but for myself, I can do whatever I want because that's my own money. So I can wake up in the morning or stay late at night and collect everything I want. Nobody will complain, you know? But when you are an investor, you have fiduciary duty towards the investor that basically provide you with money. And ideally, you need to provide not only more money back at the end that they gave you, but you need to also make them happy by what they collect with you, and eventually they learn with you. So I try to rationalize a lot. And yes, we have a kind of relatively not complex, but we have a very thorough process. And basically, because we are professional investors, we start with what we call an investment universe that is made of the 400 most liquid collections of the digital art world. And then we basically go through the funnel by reducing certain things and dividing between segments, going through the top 20 of each segment, and then doing kind of analysis of one collection against the other. So for instance, Xcopy, he has many, many, many collections. And we say, okay, each copy, this one is good. Everything is good, but this one is maybe cheaper than the other one. That's the way we do. Again, we start with a big investment universe of 400 collections, and then we start to analyze and to reduce. And at the end, we arrive at an investment universe that is around 40, 50 collections. And then that's where we really discuss. That's where we go in a more fundamental analysis. And that's also where we do some bets. And the bets are, you know, from one segment to the other or within a segment. And just to provide a little bit of alpha of the way we think, right now the market is, at the end of 2023, the market was 2/3 in terms of market cap collectibles and 15% gen art, 5% AI art, and the rest. So if you apply very beta way of the market, you would just buy 66% of collectible and et cetera, et cetera. And we don't do that because we have a macro view that the split, the breakdown between, you know, the market share of the gen art and the AI art and maybe digital painting and glitch will be much bigger in 5 years, 10 years from now than it is today. And we basically, maybe we'll be wrong, but we believe that the market share of the collectible will reduce.
So Jean-Michel, I'd love to hear your perspective. Like, what are the grails of Grail Capital? Like, what are the collections that you've highlighted? Like, these are the winners. These are the bets I want to take. You know, these are the swings that I'm taking. And what are like the common threads, the pattern recognition that you have going between them?
I mean, the grails that Grail Capital is looking at and looking after and looking forward to collecting, you know, there is no surprise for anybody. Those are the big names that you all know. So the Fidenza, the CryptoPunk, the Xcopy, the Squiggles, the Ringers. Basically, it's very, very simple. You just look at the top 20 in terms of value of art and you get it. But we are not only investing in what we call blue chip art. We're also collecting what we call rising stars. And the rising stars are basically the next 20. So you've got the top 10 or top 20 artists that did a couple of collections that we all know very well that are already, for some of them, in museum and relatively expensive. But we also invest in the very next part, who are the rising stars. And those are the William Appan, the Matt Delaurier, all those people that we know very well that are great artists as well, that might have been arriving slightly after the other or have not yet had the recognition by the market than the other have, but that might eventually one day get at the same level, you know.
So on that note, like, I'm really curious about this because here at Now Media, we really do a lot of coverage and we try to provide an amplification to rising artists. But something that, as a collector, I have to put my collector hat on here, you know. I'm not going to tell you my wallets because some of them are secret. So I have to keep them. One of the things that always fascinates me is the fact that, like, how come one artist, you can have two artists enter the market at a very similar time frame, right? But then one artist just catapults, right? This for one reason or another. And sometimes, just even saying this, like, they have the same collector base. Right. I'm like, even it out. Like, I don't want to call anyone out in particular, but like, what do you think that route to go, like, just rocket ship, right? Because, like,
parabolic, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like, because there's a lot of stuff, the same collectors, right? So a lot of people look at a lot of collector wallets and they're like, oh my God, like, we love Danny. So I'm just using Danny here because Danny's an investor and he's also a great friend of ours. But when Seed Phrase buys something, right, a lot of people chase that wallet, right? When G Money buys something, boom, right? Especially in the art world, right? When Snowfro buys something, right? But I'm so curious to hear from your perspective, outside of collectors buying them, what makes artists stand out or go to the next level? Right? Like, what is it that, is it marketing? Is it showing up on Twitter? Is it being at the right fairs? Like, what is it from your perspective that makes one artist rise while the others kind of stagnate or quote unquote give up?
Yeah. Oh my God. That's such a great question. It could be a book.
You should. Like that, you should. I would read it.
I'd buy it, you know?
No, I think, again, because I've studied street art a lot, and exactly what you just said, actually, I lived it. I experienced it real time with two artists at the same moment doing approximately the same thing. And eventually one makes it and the other not. And it's not a question of talent. Because I really remember back in the days of the street art where I knew very, very talented artists that were doing murals, crazy murals and stencil that were like as good as, if not as better than Banksy. And eventually they didn't make it and they quit basically. Because after some time, you know, you just quit. So that's a great question. I must say, I've got a theory to answer that question, which I call the artist entrepreneur and the artist artist. So for me, there are, and sorry, because I've got also a lot of friends just like you guys with a lot of artists, and it's always difficult to put people within frames, but sometimes we have to when we try to rationalize things. So for me, there is two main categories of artists. There is the artist entrepreneur and the artist artist. The artist artists are the equivalent of Jean-Michel Basquiat, Vincent Van Gogh, you know, real artists, genius, not so easy to manage, probably not very stable in terms of, you know, their daily life, etc. But they don't really care, and for them, art is the thing, and they can't not do art. And what happened to those guys, whether Van Gogh or Basquiat, is that they have the chance to meet someone that will take care of their career. In the instance of Van Gogh, it's the wife of his late brother that died 6 months after him, but his wife continued to do the job, and that's basically because of her that Van Gogh now is famous. And for Basquiat, it's his meeting with Warhol, and Warhol having him meeting with Leo Castelli and all the big players in the New York market in the early 80s. So I think this is one important thing. And you've got the other category, which is the artist entrepreneur. And the artist entrepreneur, this is Warhol. This is, you know, who both is a great artist, but also good at marketing. Just what you said, good at marketing, good at showing up at the right fair, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not negative, I must say, because we need both. And both are doing great for art. And now if you transpose that to the digital art market right now, well, it's relatively easy to see that Beeple, for instance, for me, is very equivalent to Warhol in a way, because he has a big organization around him. And I had the chance to, as you guys, to be in Charleston a couple of times. And wow, the team he has around is really amazing. And he's 15, 20 people, his brother, his wife, his parents are not far, and a couple of people managing both the studio, the museum, and everything. I mean, this is a real company, you know. So there's already something around Beeple that makes him a real entrepreneur. And even though, you know, sometimes you can when you have a chat with him, you can believe that he's a bit not crazy, but like on the edge, I would say sometimes.
Actually, eccentric.
Eccentric is the right word. Thank you. That's my French limitation. But eccentric is the right word. But I mean, he's super smart, and I remember having a couple of discussions with him. And you can see that his brain is functioning extremely fast. And voilà. So again, that's for me, those kind of thing. I don't know if I really answered your question, but for me, I try to understand which artist in which category. Because if the artist is an artist, it means that to be successful, this person will need something or someone to help them. Because if they don't have, that will be tough.
You provided an example of an artist entrepreneur. Who would you say is an artist in our space right now?
Who would be an artist right now? That's tuck. Okay, who could I give you? Alors, yeah. It's a tough question because most of the people I know are artist entrepreneur, or maybe, I don't know, someone that I like a lot with Yu-Yu, Cyber Yu-Yu, you know, he's great. I think he's a real artist. And I think he has his agent that is helping him, Alex, that is helping him a lot. I think that's probably one key example because I saw him last week. So that's the first I can think of. I would say, and obviously I don't know very well Tyler Hobbs, so I don't know how much Tyler
is an artist.
He's an artist. Like
he has a good team, but he's like an artist at his core. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he's like, yo, I'm out from Twitter. He's like, I'm out from social media. I can't get anything to like, my team will be the one responding to things, but like, yeah, he strikes me as like artist. Yeah.
I would say Fuocious as well is like an artist. Obviously has a great team now, but like, I remember like in the early days before Fuo had a team, like a lot of people were trying to like take advantage of him and the like, so.
Yeah, you're right. And
Rafiq as well. Rafiq is also an artist. He's blending into a little bit of artist entrepreneur, but he's artist.
Yeah, exactly. So again, we try to put all the people in those different categories. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, if I, for instance, if I have an artist I like a lot that has a lot of potential, but that is in the artist category, I try to advise this artist to either find an agent or to find a collective of other artists or whatever, so that they can grow. Because, you know, some of them are extremely talented, but indeed they might miss the little thing that requires to be successful. And at the end of the day, you know, it's not perfect math or perfect, you know, processes. There's a lot of magic, and sometimes, you know, there's something that happens and something that it simply doesn't happen. So we have to also acknowledge that.
I want to ask you about that magic. Is it a mandate of yours to spend time with the artist that you buy? Like, for example, if you buy a Fidenza, you're like, I need to spend time with Tyler. Or if you buy a Rafiq, I want to spend time with the Rafiq, right? Like, is it a mandate of yours? Because there's so much energy, right? There's so much energy exchange, and you can just tell when an artist has it. I don't know about you, but we can tell, like, when that spark or something, right? You're like, whoa, I don't know, but how much of your, yeah. I think, let me phrase this a better way. Two-part question. Do you spend time with every artist you collect? And how much of your investments are collecting from whether it's an investor or a collector is based on your intuition?
I will start by the first question, which is, do we invest only in artists we know? I would say yes. Because we have this approach of collecting that is also a kind of investment. So we have to understand who the artist is, what he or she thinks, and also what is his or her vision in the long term. Because, for instance, I never met Tyler Hobbs, but I don't need, because, you know, there's a lot of articles, a lot of friends of me who know him and who have been chatting with him. So for Tyler, it's very special, and same for Rafiq. For those two, I don't need to meet them, because I wish I could meet them at some point, but I don't need to know who they are, what they do, because there are so much literature, articles, interviews, everything. I think that even though I don't know them, I kind of know them in a way. But especially for rising stars, it's indeed extremely important to meet. Just to make the distinction, it's just like when you invest in a startup, you know, you can have the exact same product from an ID perspective, two teams, coming from exactly the same school. And then eventually one will succeed and the other will not. So in a way, I'm trying to spend some time with the artist. Actually, it's not bad, because I like it, and it's also great to learn from them. But yeah, when you are an investor, I need to know, because I don't know. Let's imagine that one artist that we invest heavily in basically quit in 2 years from now. He or she stops doing art, and then, I don't know, probably that his artwork will not be worth a lot after a couple of times, because, I don't know. For instance, Robbie Barry is different, because Robbie, he quit, but then, I mean, he kind of changed.
It's a historical element with him,
right? Exactly. But let's imagine someone that quit and do something else, like singing or whatever. I'm not sure that it would be great, and I'm pretty sure that my investors will say, hey, Jean-Michel, you know, why did you invest so much in this person that, like, right now is our money, because eventually part of this money has been flowing into the pocket of this person. He's enjoying a great life, but not creating art anymore, not also maybe bitching on his own artwork of the past. I don't know, this kind of thing. So we have to know how serious, how resilient, and how visionary are the artists, and especially the resilience, because it's very, very difficult. I know artists forever. I've always been with artists in my life, and I know how tough it is. And actually, right now, as you know, guys, you know, there are very few artists that make it. You know, even some of the people that are relatively famous in Twitter and even in galleries, a lot of them are struggling to sell, you know. So,
yeah, no, it's a great point. And fascinating to hear about your process. You know, I want to put on another cap now. I'm going to put on the curator hat, because yeah. I know, Jean-Michel, I know you and I both love artist discovery. And I know what's funny is we're often drawn to a lot of the same artists. You know, I just remember a couple of weeks back, I remember hitting publish on Next Up. Next Up is our rising artist franchise. Every week we spotlight a different artist. And I've hit publish on Nice Aunties.
Oh my God.
I can see your face light up. I know it. Nice Aunties, you know, the Singaporean AI artist that's been creating waves. And literally, I put it up on Twitter, like Nice Aunties. And then I also see a Jean-Michel post on like Nice Aunties. And like, you know, we clearly hadn't seen each other's, but we were both on the same artist same day. So like, how do you discover artists and how do you like, what is that process like for you as a curator? And like, you know, for me, it gives me energy. I get excited about it. I'm curious to hear that, like put on that curator hat for us.
So if we take the example of Nice Aunties, it has been on my radar for months. I've been watching her, obviously the video specifically. I can't remember during, was it in Feb or maybe no before, it was probably in either during December or even before. I really spent some time, you know, digging into the your artistic universe, and I was attracted, you know, but most of the time I'm trying always to analyze my instinct. Because sometimes my eyes are right, and sometimes it's not right. It's just something that is appealing to me is not necessarily there to stay. You know, I can sometimes find something appealing in terms of aesthetics, in terms of stuff, but eventually it will not be there in 5-10 years. And again, I always want to collect something that will still be there in 5-10 years, that will matter culturally and then economically. But with Nice Aunties, it took me some time, and actually I think that, so it's very, actually, well, I can quote now, but I was in London just before the drop, probably the day or 2 days before, and I had a drink with Lord Truffington, so I have to give him the credit for that. Yeah. And we were chatting, you know, he's a big collector as well, and we were chatting about many things, and basically among the many things we discussed, he said, oh, Nice Aunties, you need to dive into that. I said, I know. I was prepared to kind of deep dive into that. But because he told me, I said, okay, I will deep dive sooner than later. And so I participated to the drop that they did. I think it was the 7th of February. And by the way, I was in Eurostar. So with the Wi-Fi, that was like a bit...
Yeah, the Eurostar Wi-Fi needs an upgrade, man.
Oh, my God. I had no Wi-Fi on my way there. I was trying to like hotspot it. And like it was so janky. Anyway.
We need Starlink too.
Exactly. By the way, the journey between Paris and Switzerland is way better in terms of Wi-Fi. But the views as well. Probably. But basically, yeah, that's how I've not discovered it, but I took some time around it, and then eventually I said, okay, I have a strong conviction. So I think exactly the same thing you said, Matt. Just at the same moment that you were posting your great article, I posted something that I do very rarely. That is, okay, I showed that I bought like 20 or 25, and I say, well, guys, I think I have a conviction for that collection. And I still
When you buy 20 to 25, that's a big conviction.
Yeah, and it's personal. It's not Grail. It's me as a collector, not Grail Capital.
Okay, so now, like, this is a question that I'd love to ask, because, like, we're so caught up in the world of, look at my wins, right? Like, look, I called this. Yes, I did this, right? Like, look, the receipts, right? But I want to bring this over from investing, and you probably know this. It's called the anti-portfolio.
Oh my God.
Right?
Oh God.
For our listeners that don't know what the anti-portfolio is, it comes from venture capital. When venture capitalists take a meeting with a potential unicorn or startup, and they look at it, they say, oh my God, this looks great, but no, thank you. Right? So a lot of investors, when things IPO or they think sold for billions or hundreds of millions of dollars, they're like, they take a badge of honor by saying, oh, we passed on this, right? Like, but they kind of do it. Is there any particular rising artist that you had the chance, like, right? So like that you had the chance to buy them at floor. So I'll give you an example, and this is a true story. All right. I think it was December 2021 or January 2022. I think it was December 21. I meet Isaac Drifter Shoots. I meet Drifter Shoots, and I'm like, yo, I spent like an hour with him. We were just chatting about it. And I go back to MadBed and I go, Matt, bro, this guy Drifter Shoots, he's the real deal. He's about to blow up. His story is just bonkers. And I was about to hit buy on where the Vans go, right? Mind you, it was like 0.33, 0.33, 0.4, like a third of an ETH, right? Something like that. And because I trust Matt so much.
You can't put this on me.
Matt's like, I don't know. Mind you, I think it was like a few weeks before we put him on the next up, right? Because like finally came over.
You wanted to put him on the podcast. I was like, I want him on. I know he's got a good story. I don't know if he's podcast level yet. We'll get there, you know?
Yeah, I'm so glad that history proved this. But my anti-portfolio, my first anti-portfolio in NFT art was Drifter Shoots, right? So I shot myself in the foot not once but twice with him, right? So what's your story, Jean-Michel?
I've got so many. We'll spend 1 hour, so I will just pick 3 or 4, and then I want to know who are the anti-portfolio for format. So the very first one that comes to mind is Grand Tune.
Me too.
Same.
I know him since almost not the beginning, but when he started to be a little bit known, and then we were chatting together because I love him actually, and we were chatting on DM, and at some point I think it was around he already started to increase. You know, it was already at around 8-10 maybe ETH for his one-on-one. And he reached out to via DM and he said, "Okay, Jean-Michel, I would be very proud if you would be the next collector of this piece, and if we can maybe doing the next all time high for me, like at 10 or something, would be great." Obviously, I passed, and obviously, you know, I regret it, but that's part of this. So with Grant, and it's very special because I know him, but and we chat, and it would have been a kind of OTC deal. And among the other, there's one famous for myself, which is Autoglyph. So the story is that there is someone I know who, just like I did with Lord Truffington, you know, discussing about what he's collecting, what he likes, etc. One collector basically sent me a list of things he kind of was collecting. And among those, there was Autoglyph. There was 5, and there was Autoglyph in the middle. And I remember saying to myself, you know, not sure, because visually it was not appealing to me, and that was my mistake. You know, I didn't see the historical element, the technological component, and the cultural component, and so I passed miserably on that. So that's the second one that I regret. And obviously, for me, the worst is CryptoPunks, because they were around me all the time. I remember when I was at Ledger when they pop up, because I was known for collecting street art. And because I was collecting Space Invader that was doing tiles. So technically speaking, those were the CryptoPunks before they were CryptoPunks.
You fucked up, bro.
I fucked up. It's just like, you know, bomb, bomb, bomb. I fucked at all the moment, basically. So yeah, this is the worst anti-portfolio that I can show.
Ooh.
And you, Matt. Wow. And you, Matt.
All right. I'll get into it. Well, Grant. Well, we shared a distinction of having Grant Yoon in our anti-portfolios. I was aware of his work quite early. I was like, this is cool. Like this, you know, I'm getting a vibe from it. And, oh, you know, I've got time. Let me keep it. You know, like just a couple artists I have my eye on. Blah blah blah. Next thing you know, it's you know, it's and what was funny too was like literally. So we put together the NFT 100 that year. You know, and I remember I was like. You know, like, oh, Grant Yoon, like, you know, he's like, he's not quite there. And then literally like the week after we release it, he like pops off and everyone's like, where's Grant Yoon? Where's Grant Yoon? God. And I was like, oh, he was on the cusp while we were doing it. You know what I mean? It was like, so I felt like I missed Grant Yoon personally. And then we also like, you know, like institutionally, we were like, you know, we should have put Grant Yoon in that year, but it was like very overdue the next year. So that was one of them. You know, one that comes to mind and it was just so obvious, was Matt Cain's Gazers. Like, oh my God, dude. I've been on Matt Cain since the very beginning. My first article ever on NFT Now was 10 crypto art OGs you need to know, back when we were a Substack, before we had a website, you know? And Matt Cain was on there. I've been on his tilt. He's a fellow Matt. He's literally team Matt. And he released one of the coolest art blocks collections ever. And I was just like, slapped. I like whiffed on that. Yeah. I whiffed on it hard. The last one that comes to mind, this one actually is a little bit of a happy ending, but like was Alpha Centauri Kid, because ACK You know, I became aware of his work. I was like, this is awesome. I love it. I go to DM him to be like, hey man, I want to curate you for Christie's in the First Gateway. And I see there's this whole message history I'd never seen. And literally at the top, he was like, hey Matt, I made you a one of one with a Tezos link to his old secret Tezos wallet. And I was like, what? And I go to click it and he was like, and it like belongs to some other wallet. And he was like, oh, did you claim it? And I was like, no. He was like, oh man, someone else must have claimed it. It was a free claim. And it said like, it said for Medved, a gift. It had my Medved CryptoPunk. And I was just like beside myself. And, but you know, I was like, yo, let's get you involved at Christie's, all this. And then I like spent like a whole year trying to track down who had it. You know what I mean? And like when Object finally allowed you to make bids, those you know, like those bids, oh, I can make an offer. I made a 69 Tez offer because that's what you do. And then like 2 months later, it was accepted because the person didn't know it was Alpha Centauri Kid. So it did make its way to me at like a year. It was a year and a half saga in the making.
Yeah, that's what I love about Alpha Centauri Kid, man. He does something. He trolls people, man. So he came on our podcast and he creates fake or pseudonyms or anonymous accounts, and he then DMs people like, hey man, would you like to see this artwork? Because like, that's how he experiments, right? And only if the collector collects it or says yes, he then unveils himself as like, hey, that's actually my art piece, right? Which is crazy. And when he told me this, I was going through my DMs.
Same. I was like, is it this guy? Is it that guy? You know?
You were about to say something, Jean-Michel. What were you about to say?
Go ahead.
No, because actually what Matt just said about the story of the artwork actually is amazing, because, you know, artwork in itself, there is story behind the artwork and there is story that the artist put in the artwork. But the person relationship and the person relationship that you build with an artist and the person relationship and the personal story that you have with an artwork actually is amazing, because it brings additional cultural value to the artwork. I mean, if he had been ACK, had been minting that and you just buy it, I mean, without this story, that will probably not be the same artwork, the value for you, but also even the value maybe 5-10 years again from now, because there will be a story attached to that that make it even more special. So that's also the kind of thing that are very interesting to know, you know, from an investor and collector standpoint. And that also comes back to the provenance, you know, to the provenance, you know, and the contact.
To that story, he did a girl on a piano in the middle of it, and for the First Gateway. So he made this very specific art piece. Oh, yeah. And the moment that it sold, Girl with Balloon. Yeah. And the moment it sold, it turned into a Pepe.
Pepe with Balloon. He thought I was going to be mad at him because he had, and I was like, no, I love it. I was like, dude, I love it. I was like, I'm here for you. He's like, oh, phew. You know, he's like, I had to do it. The muse told me, like, I had to do it. He's like, oh, I'm going to piss off Matt. I'm going to piss off Christie. So I was like, nah, dude. Like,
whatever. It's really awesome. All right. Speaking of stories, let's bring out the crystal ball out. Let's bring this crystal ball out.
Ooh.
Let's talk about where you see art going to be, digital art. Let's talk about the industry first, and then we can go into like specific grails or specific artists, things of that nature. You know, one of our missions at Now Media is to bring digital art front and center next to art. We just want digital art to be called art. You know, we have the gateway. Our mission is to really bring art front and center. And we share that love, Jean-Michel. So tell us, where do you see the industry, let's say 5 years, 10 years from now, as a digital art, as a financial instrument, as a cultural instrument, and as an artistic instrument?
Oh, I've got a long-term vision that is massive for digital art. Massive. Obviously, what I don't really manage is, you know, the time it will take to get where I see it. But anything between 5 to 15 years, for me, digital art will be probably the most important current cultural movement, I would say, that will be in the largest, biggest, most famous museum, and that will be in the best, private collections of the world. That's a known fact. I mean, and there is no other way, because there are so many things that are colliding with digital art on blockchains. Because there's a technological component, there is a cultural component, and there is an art component. And the reason why, so for the technological component, NFT, as everybody knows, you know, is actually a very smart way to create scarcity, provenance, and etc. for a digital artifact, whether it's a collectible or a piece of art. And that was not possible 10 years ago. So that's, for me, the first component. Then you have the kind of cultural component, which is the fact that nowadays, most of our lives is digital. I mean, we are talking over, you know, a podcast, but, you know, via video, we chat via DM, we send us WhatsApp, and sometimes we meet in person, which is great, but 95% of our lives and our relationship are made digital. And that's the case, and that probably will continue to be the case. And art and culture is one of the very last part of our life that before NFT were not digitalized. So, and I see that is something that even if people don't want it, it will be the case because that's just the natural flow of things. And the last part, which is the art part, I think, and that's probably why there's so much confusion in the mind of so many people outside of our world regarding NFTs, and that's why it's a world that is not very well understood and that so much people don't like it, is because on top of those two components, the cultural and the technological, there is the art world, which is also a new art current. Just like you had street art, just like you had impressionist and stuff, you have NFT art, which is this kind of big big thing with you know, glitch, gen art, AI art, digital painting, photography, etc., etc. So all the art current that kind of are put inside a single kind of term that is NFT art. And for those three things, I think that they will just catapult the market again in between 5 to 15 years to an expected height from a cultural standpoint and also from a financial and economic standpoint. And again, to come back to the question of Matt at the very start of this conversation, you know, why I launched Rail is because in 5, 10 years, I hope, if I can, still be there, you know. And I want to see that. I want to, you know, I want to go to Fondation Louis Vuitton in Paris and have a full hail of digital art. And again, I think it's impossible that they don't do it. It's impossible.
That's powerful. Let's keep the crystal ball out for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I want to get a little granular.
Yeah, yeah.
I would because look, you're by running a fund like this, by doing this, I know you also have price targets, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's hear someone. Like, what's your price target? Like on a certain time horizon for like CryptoPunks? What about Squiggles? What about Fidenzas, Autoglyphs? Like, give us the highlights.
Oh my God. So let's start by the CryptoPunks because again, I missed them miserably so many times that, you know, I had at some point to say, okay, well, I missed them. I need to know how much they will value so that I can really be pissed off even more. But by the way, professionally, we have CryptoPunks in the digital art fund. Personally, I still don't have, so I need to work on that. Even though every day it gets, you know, more expensive. So right now, I think we're at around 200K USD, right, in terms of floor price. And obviously, for that, you probably have better floor price ones. My take is that in probably less than 5 years, it will be 1 million minimum. So I don't see a world where a CryptoPunk will not be available at more than 1 million. That's my take. And I might be wrong by a couple of years, but no more than that.
I agree.
100%. Yeah.
Full disclosure, I do have a punk, so, you know, but I agree. Yeah.
So that's my first kind of price target. The other one, which is a little bit more sophisticated in a way, it's for Chromie Squiggle, for instance, because Chromie Squiggle are amazing. What I like with them as well is that they are generative art, but most of the people don't need to understand that it's generative art. They just like the shape, they just like the color, and it's very universal. I you know, we are doing some stickers for Grail Capital, and basically we did some of the Squiggle we own, and I give them to even people who are not into art and not into crypto and not into NFTs. They just like the colors, they just like the shape. They find it interesting and appealing. So for me, the Squiggle could be this kind of cultural thing that you see on T-shirts and caps and many things like that. That could become also very expensive. I don't know what the floor price right now. It's around 20-25k, I would say.
Yeah,
something like that.
60,
yeah, 670. Yeah, so let's say that,
valued, you know, to be honest.
I would say that, you know,
very 6.5 ETH right now. The floor is 6.5.
Yeah, so it's around 20k. Let's kind of simplify at 20k USD, because, oh yeah, by the way, guys, very important. I value everything in USD. I don't look at the artworks in ETH. I look at the artwork in USD.
Oh, that's controversial. That's controversial. Yeah. What do you say to the purist of the space that, like, you know, that say one ETH equals one ETH, you know?
I mean, I am myself a collector.
Well, you just told me you weren't. You know what I mean?
So
You mean like your fund approach?
With my fund, with our fund, we are taking commitments in USD. All the valuations are made in USD.
It's not increasing the USD.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So it's okay. So let me ask you this question. Okay. So on that point, if everything's denominated in USD, right? Let's say the price of ETH goes way down to, like, God forbid, right? But the amount of ETH increases, right? What happens with your accounting there?
But it's okay as soon as the price in USD increase.
Oh, because so you hold the ETH.
You know, it's a simple rule of thumb. Sorry, we collect whatever we collect, either USD, ETH, or USDC. At the start, we convert everything into ETH. We collect ART into ETH, but then the valuation is in USD. So technically speaking, we are fully exposed to Ethereum for now because the first investment vehicle was fully invested in ETH. But maybe that the next one will be in Ordinals and other stuff, but we are mostly exposed to ETH. And again, the price of ETH can have an impact. And actually, I will tell you a story about the Chromie Squiggle that in the market we call the stablecoin. Because if you look at the price of a squiggle, basically in USD terms, it is very stable. If you look over
2025, right?
Yeah. It stays within a corridor. Yeah, maximum 25, minimum 18, I think, for the past 12 months. So it's very, very stable in a very volatile market. So that's interesting. But I believe that Chromie Squiggle will go out by the upper side of the corridor. And again, I don't see a world in which the squiggle are not worth at least 100k USD in the next 5 years. Again, maybe I'm mistaken, but that's my take. What else do we have in terms of a big, bold statement that I could give? And then,
What about Rafiq's work?
Oh, this is a great question. Those one, it's we are still working on it because I think that I like what it does. I think, you know, unsupervised has played a big role in the adoption and the visibility and the institutionalization of digital art. So this is great, but I still need to understand. I need to work around, you know, the quantity, the quality, and everything, because I'm still struggling, you know, if I had to pick, you know, between any of his collection, for instance. I think my mind is not made up yet. I think, you know, from a cultural standpoint, that would make sense that the unsupervised are getting the best valuation because it's at the MoMA, so, well. And at the same time, I think it's still very cheap, and you've got the wins on the other side that have been through the roof.
The Yamanawa ones?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, I need to work on that. So I'm still work in progress. You know, we have an opinion on a lot of things, but there are some of them that are still work in progress, I would say.
All right.
What about Xcopy? Let's get Xcopy in there. Good one to end that on. Yeah, like where are you seeing those early Xcopy 101s? Like, you know, obviously they've sold for something, like, you know, you look at like right click save guy with Cozumo, you know, like, you know, was that an outlier or is like where is it going?
Summer, even as late as JPEG Summer was nice, dude.
Yeah, those are amazing. Those are amazing pieces. And this is difficult to value. We are better at valuing one of X.
Sure. Within a collection. Yeah.
But then, my take on that, and again, that's a bold statement, but for me, because I'm evaluating everything in USD, and because I believe that, again, the digital artists of today will be the biggest artists in 5, 10, 15 years from now, I tend to believe that the price of the art market usually tend to go in the same direction and to go into kind of same price tags, I would say. So that's what I said the other day. I think that it wouldn't surprise me if Fidenza cost the same price as a Warhol at some point, or Xcopy, same price as a Warhol. And the wallet is anything between 10 to 40K, 40 million, sorry. So, you know, that wouldn't surprise me if they reach that point. And we saw recently, I think yesterday or the day before, you know, this bid on a very rare CryptoPunks again, which is I don't know how many millions, but, you know. So, yeah, again, I think we'll have a very interesting market in the next 5, 10, 15 years. And again, the Tyler Hobbs, the Xcopy, the Beeple, the Ferocious, the Eric Calderon, and all those great artists, they will be, you know, the most successful of their time.
All right, one final personal question before we go into our bullish or bearish segment, and I'll tell you all about this. Tell us the story behind the blue hat. Like, we gotta know the story, like the elephant in the room, you know? Yeah, yeah. We gotta know the blue hat.
Saving the hard ones for last, you know, the real curveballs.
Okay. So there is two reasons for the blue cap. The first one is because I was at Ledger, because I was known at Ledger in a certain environment. I wanted to build a new persona, and because I already started to be a collector, but I wanted to create something that someone, a persona that was different from the guy who was a senior manager at Ledger, doing fundraising, finance, and stuff like that. So, and because I'm French, and because, you know, there's a lot of people I had the chance to meet in the fashion world, you have a couple of people in the fashion world that are famous for having some kind of uniform. You know, they have a special characteristic, whether it's the glass, whether it's the cap, or if not the cap, but the haircut or whatever, that makes them very special and that kind of define them, and they don't change. And, you know, the blue cap, why? But because their emoji exists. I wanted to have a characteristic that I could put on an emoji. And the blue cap was available. And I looked into Twitter and a couple of other things, and I didn't see a lot of blue cap, you know, people kind of, people famous using blue cap. So I said, well, it's free. So why not getting the blue cap, you know? And actually, at the end of the day, it's super convenient because you can have, and I have a lot of bad hair day, so it's very easy for me to just put a cap. I don't have to take care of anything. It's very convenient in the winter because you are hot. It's very, very cool in the summer. So for me, that's the perfect characteristic. So that's probably one of my best ideas so far, beyond obviously the investment.
All right. We'd love it. You guys hear it here, the source, you know? All right. Jean-Michel, we have this segment called Bullish or Bearish. It's very simple. It's a rapid fire situation where we come in. We will spit out a couple statements. You tell us whether you're bullish on it or bearish. You can give an explanation or not. But, you know, the more controversial, the better, as I always say, you know?
Okay.
Matt, you want to kick us off with bullish or bearish?
I'll kick it off with one I pick I already know the answer to. But, you know, I know that you at Grail Capital, you have your AI art index that you often reference in the reports. And it's always really interesting for me to see that broken down against generative art and different areas there. So bullish or bearish on AI art as an asset class?
Super mega bullish.
Super mega bullish. All right. I got to ask you this question one. I got to ask you this one. OpenSea.
That's a tough question. Honestly, I can't bearish right now, but, you know, I want to add to that they played a key role in that, and I appreciate them for that. And they might bounce back. And we are using them actually at Grail. We are using many, many platforms and brokers because we just want to get the best prices and the best supply. So, no, they have been important. They are still important. I think that, yeah, they're probably lagging behind, but they might bounce back at some point. So don't kill them too quickly, I think. And the guys are smart. So as always, when someone is smart, usually, you know, they find a way. So bearish right now, but...
That's fair. Very, very, very even-handed. I like that. Very diplomatic. So Jean-Michel, I'm curious to get your thought here too. Like, bullish or bearish on OG crypto art? And what I mean by that is like, not just like the early X copy, right? Yeah, like not right. Just like, I'm talking about some of these crypto artists that are outside of like, you know, the usual, like obvious suspects.
The fringe OG.
Like some of the ones who are early, but aren't necessarily getting, have big markets now. did that ship sail for them? Are you bullish or bearish on them having an like a market in the future?
I am bullish, but I'm cautiously bullish because for me the OG market of crypto or crypto art, generally speaking, and specifically collectibles and stuff, will not be equal. So some of them will be rediscovered 1 year, 2 years, 5 years from now by NFT historical people. That will find connectivity between one collection and the other. So bullish for that. But I think that being OG doesn't mean you are good. It's not because you were the first that you are the best. That's, Ledger was not the first company to do hardware wallets. Definitely not. And we didn't care. What we wanted to be was the best, not the first. So I tend to believe that OG crypto art will behave well for a part of the segment that you guys know, but some other part might just disappear, I think, because of the quality and the cultural aspect that is not good enough.
All right. Bitcoin ordinals, bullish or bearish?
Ooh. I have a problem with that.
Ooh, tell us more.
Yeah. I think I'm part of this category of people who believe that Bitcoin, because I was kind of not born and raised, but I've been kind of.
Are you a Bitcoin maxi? Are you laser eyes? Are you
No. Because I'm investing most of the fund in Ethereum. So definitely not a Bitcoin maximalist. But for me, the real use case of Bitcoin was really this transfer of value, of monetary value, basically. And as we all know, the Bitcoin blockchain is not made for doing too many things in terms of in terms of stock, in terms of space and inventory of the block. So I think the ordinals will do extremely well, and we've seen that, I think, over the past 4 months. I mean, the performance of the ordinals is wow. But for now, my mind is not made up yet regarding how much we would like to invest in that with Green Capital, for instance. So apart if investors are knocking on the door and say, okay, guys, go as long as possible on ordinals, I would still get a little bit distant from it for the very long term, collection in museum stuff. I will probably be wrong on that one, and I will be happy to be wrong on that one, but that's not where I want to go for now.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Jean-Michel, merci beaucoup for joining us. Thank you so much. Any final last words before we shut it down, Jean-Michel?
Well, guys, I really believe we are early. So for those of you who listen to this podcast, it's not late, definitely not. CryptoPunks might be 200K, but look at around, get a squiggle. You won't regret it. Get ACK, get whoever you want in the people we mentioned during that call and in podcast. And I'm sure that in 10 years from now, your children will thank you for that. That will pay at least their university, if not more than that. So yeah, do it for that. And again, don't worry for the short term. Just care for the medium to long term, because eventually you will be so right, then you will be very happy.
There it is. There it is. Jean-Michel, always a pleasure. Honestly, we could do a whole nother hour just getting that crystal ball out, but I'm sure we'll have you back on again. Best of luck with all things Grail Capital, and we will talk to you soon. Yo, I know I always say that I really enjoyed that conversation, but I really enjoyed that conversation. I could have gone on for hours.
I know you could have, man. You're a curator, artist, connoisseur, man. Like this shit is like your blood, your sweat, your tears, your love of it. It's like if you could put you inside an IV, you'd continue dripping this conversation all day long. Matt, I think one of the things that really stood out for me though in this conversation outside our very natural dialogue was his honesty around the things that he hasn't really captured, right? So many investors, so many collectors, they only want to showcase their wins, their big wins. But when we asked him about his anti-portfolio, he was just very candid, very open from that perspective. And I think what I really love about him, he's always been playing the long-term game, right? I know that we had a conversation off camera after the show, and the thing that really kind of impacted me as a father now is he said to us, are you building something that your kids will be proud of in 5-10 years? And that was really amazing because that he's really emotionally, intellectually, and financially invested in the into this industry and community. What stood out for you?
Yeah, no, like, you know, you could just tell that, like, it comes from such a place of passion for him. Like, he's got that, like, you have to be sober and you know, calculated as to be a successful investor, you know, with a fund in the space and all that. But you can tell, like, he just gets so excited around discovery. And that passion, I think, is really driving it. And you feel that when you speak to him. And you can tell he's just enjoying himself. Like, he's enjoying himself, like, while doing it. And you can't fake that.
Yeah, he's fucking, like, around. He's finding out.
That's exactly it. And you also see that conviction. Like, you know, I always say it's like it takes a couple cycles to get that conviction, right? And, you know, Jean-Michel's been through a few and he knows. And that's why, like, you know, I think he knew that, like, he had to make that move with Grail Capital, even though I'm sure it would have been so easy for him to stay at Ledger. You know what I mean? Like, I think about, like, you know, the jumps we made to start Now Media and NFT Now at the time. Like, you know, we had comfortable situations before, but we made that jump because we knew that we were on the precipice of something really important and at a time that couldn't just be, like, recaptured, right? And so, like, I see that spirit in him, and it's really awesome to see that.
Absolutely. Well, guys, remember, all of our podcasts, we couldn't do it without you. We do this for our community. We want to make sure that you guys are educated, informed, to make the right decisions in such a volatile space. But please, when you have a second, please give us that 5-star review. You know, like, please comment, review, 5 stars, not any less. I know this ain't Uber, but we still need the reviews, all right? If you had a good ride, if you had enjoyed the conversation, thank you so much. And if you ever have any ideas on who we should bring onto the podcast, please DM us. We're on Twitter. We're on Discord. Just let us know. We'd love to have your guest as well on the podcast.
There it is. Until next time, we will see you again next week on the NFT Now podcast.